Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
Here Be Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Well, today's a celebration because the poet and fiction writer and essayist and playwright Eileen Miles has come out with two books. Eileen's new and selected poems have just come out under the title, I Must Be Living Twice. And I think this is the first time that a poet from the so-called downtown New York scene has made it between hardcovers from a major mainstream press. In this case, it's Echo, which is a division of HarperCollins. I've been reading Eileen since 1982, when a poet here, Dennis Cooper, published her book Sappho's Boat. I was introduced to Eileen's poetry by Dennis Cooper, and I've been reading it ever since. This volume contains poems from all of her books of poems, and side by side with it in paperback is her novel. I think it's really a book of stories or connected stories, but we'll call it novel.
I like novel.
Novel, okay. Yeah. Chelsea Girls. And they're both masterpieces. It's really thrilling that these books exist. Chelsea Girls has been out of print for nearly a decade. It's an astonishing work of autobiographical self-discovery, but so are the poems too. I'm going to start off by asking Eileen to read one of her most famous early poems, The American Poem.
I was born in Boston in 1949. I never wanted this fact to be known. In fact, I've spent the better half of my adult life trying to sweep my early years under the carpet and have a life that was clearly just mine and independent of the historic fate of my family. Can you imagine what it was like to be one of them? To talk like them, to be built like them, to have the benefits of being born into such a wealthy and powerful American family. I went to the best schools, had all kinds of tutors and trainers. I traveled widely. I met the famous, the controversial, and the not so admirable, and I knew from a very early age that if there were ever any possibility of escaping the collective fate of this famous Boston family, I would take that route, and I have. I hopped on an Amtrak to New York in the early 70s, and I guess you could say my hidden years began. I thought, well, I'll be a poet. What could be more foolish and obscure? I became a lesbian. Every woman in my family looks like a dyke, but it's really stepping off the flag when you become one. Well, holding this ignominious pose, I've seen and I have learned, I'm beginning to think there's no escaping history. A woman I'm currently having an affair with said, you know, you look like a Kennedy. I felt the blood rising in my cheeks. People have always laughed at my Boston accent, confusing large for lodge, party for party. But when this unsuspecting woman evoked for the first time my family name, I knew the jig was up. Yes, I am a Kennedy. My efforts to remain obscure have not served me well. Starting as a humble poet, I quickly climbed to the top of my profession, assuming a position of leadership and honor. It is right that a woman should call me out now. Yes, I am a Kennedy, and I await your orders. You are the new Americans. The homeless are wandering the streets of our nation's greatest city. Homeless men with AIDS are among them. Is that right? that there's no homes for the homeless, that there's no free medical help for these men and women, that they get the message, as they are dying, that this is not their home. And how are your teeth today? Can you afford to fix them? How high is your rent? If art is the highest and most honest form of communication of our times, and the young artist is no longer able to move here and speak to her time, yes, I could, but that was 15 years ago, and remember, as I must, I am a Kennedy. Shouldn't we all be Kennedys? This nation's greatest city is home of the businessman, home of the rich artist, people with beautiful teeth who are not on the streets. What should we do about this dilemma? Listen, I've been educated. I've learned about Western civilization. Do you know what the message of Western civilization is? I am alone. Am I alone tonight? I don't think so. Am I the only one with bleeding gums tonight? Am I the only homosexual in this room? Am I the only one whose friends have died, are dying now? And my art can't be supported until it is gigantic, bigger than everyone else's, confirming the audience's feeling that they are alone, that they alone are good, deserve to buy the tickets to see this art, are working, are healthy, should survive, and are normal. Are you normal tonight? Everyone here, are we all normal? It's not normal for me to be a Kennedy, but I am no longer ashamed. I'm no longer alone. I'm not alone tonight because we are all Kennedys, and I am your president.
Eileen Miles reading an American poem. It was from one of her early books, and now it appears in her book, I Must Be Living Twice, her new and selected poems. Of course, the first time anyone heard Eileen reading this poem, there was a lot of shouting and hilarity and astonishment. Tell me, once a poem enters your canon, mm-hmm. becomes one of the poems people inevitably want to hear, how do you feel about it? Do you get tired of it? What is a new and selected poems like for the poet herself?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, for a poem like this, it's an opportunity to figure out how to re-enter it in a different, almost in a different body. And I don't mean that this body isn't the body that wrote it. I mean, I'm a version of that. But it's sort of like you don't want to dial it in. You know what I mean? You want to get in there and figure out where the emphasis is today, what the poem would sound like today. Even today in the world in which lots of people know this poem. So how do I read it? You know, it's a little bit like being Bob Dylan or something. It's really, I mean, it's like the poetry world is not like, you know, pop music or rock music or folk music. It's not mass media. But there still is, in the audience that we have, this is proportionally as widely known as his work. You're still reading a poem to people who know it like the back of their hand. I remember when my friend Tim Dugos was alive, and he was alive at the time you and I met each other, I remember him seeing this poem and saying, Eileen, this is going to be your hit poem, you know? And Tim was very smart, and it was just, it kind of, so it's sort of like, how do you unload your hit poem? I don't have the same problem with other poems in here, but it's like revisiting your family or old friends or rooms you haven't been in for a long time or seeing where a building is gone. And also when you do a selected book by book, the order of the poems is really particular. It's very like an LP. It's very like vinyl, where it's sort of like a song finishes and you know what the next song is. And readers feel that too, and I feel that. And so it's like when you start pulling poems out and shortening the stack, you have to change the order. You know, like some people, when they picked up this book and they didn't see that the Kennedy poem was at the front of Not Me, they were like, oh no, did you pull that? No. And I was like, no, it's at the end where I always thought it should be. So you get to shuffle the deck, and that's actually really fun.
Amazing things have been happening for Eileen recently. One of her poems appears as the epigraph to the film Grandma. That stars Lily Tomlin. I was sitting there, and there on the screen was a quote from a poem by Eileen Miles. A character this coming season is going to be reading some of Eileen's poems on the show Transparent.
Uh-huh.
And another character is going to be modeled on her, and she is herself going to be appearing on the show.
Being a friend of the person who's me, which is really nuts.
Now, you've always known that you would be famous.
I mean, in that way that, like, part of I don't know, part of growing up Catholic is do you or don't you want to be a saint? And I think growing up in New York in the 70s and 80s and kind of under the kind of Andy Warhol kind of pop, hey, when did you come on the scene? As if the whole world that you were in was like a film shoot, you know? And we were all like, we were all famous. And that was sort of the feeling. But I always felt like as a poet, I wasn't lowering my expectations. I mean, I didn't mind that I was poor. I didn't mind that I was queer. I didn't mind that I had a hangover. But I always felt that this room was going to connect to another room and another room and another room. And I didn't think I should really have a day job to fall back on. I thought being a poet was enough. So I guess that's a certain expectation of something good.
I'm talking to Eileen Miles about her new, well, her new old books.
Right, right.
One of them is I Must Be Living Twice, which is new and selected poems. Almost all except around, what would you say, 10 poems have appeared before.
Uh-huh.
And Chelsea Girls, her great novel of growing up queer in New England, coming to New York, getting honest as can be. I mean, I was rereading the piece about your father last night. Mm-hmm. That's one incredibly moving piece.
Thank you.
Do you like it still?
I do, because it was just like the trick for that in that story was to figure out how to write something that has such, you know, melancholy and sentimentality potentially, which is the, what it's like to be the child of an alcoholic and to watch a beloved parent die. You know, and at the time of the writing, I figured the only way to handle it was to make it be about the materiality of waiting in a car outside of a bar, what the inside of the car felt like, kids are always making up, you know, what's candy and what's velvet and what's secrets and what's time. You know, you don't know what language is even when somebody says, I got to go get a Bromo. You know, it's a Bromo, you know?
Well, you see, that's the wonderful thing. You didn't even know it was the outside of a bar. And when you went into it, it looked like a soda shop, you know,
there
dark.
Was a parrot. So is this a pet shop? I mean, it was just like kids are just making the world up all the time. So I feel like, especially with that story, what I feel like I'm doing is writing the soundtrack to something that's already been shot, but you don't know what it means. And as an adult, you get to articulate what was actually going on some level.
I often look at a blog called Literary Hub.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And there was a poem by you there. And often, I'll say it directly, I often say I like Eileen's earlier poems better than I like her more recent ones.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read this poem called Western Poem, and my eyes popped open. I thought it was so beautiful and so musical.
Uh-huh.
That I even said, well, you know, sometimes I guess there might be 100 poems before I read one that really hits me like
uh-huh.
this.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was one of the most beautiful things you'd ever done. I got the music in the other, but here, I'll tell you, I don't know what this poem, which we're about to have you read.
Yes.
I don't know what it's about.
Uh-huh.
But it's so beautiful to
right.
me.
Oh, thank you.
That I wrote Eileen a note. We're not in regular contact, but I just had to say, this is gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And I want my listeners to hear it too. This is Eileen Miles reading Western Poem, so new.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even in the new book, I Must Be Living Twice, but I think it's, you know, I don't know, one of mm-hmm. the magnificent poems I've run into.
That's so great.
Recently.
Western Poem. Purple clouds, my doubts. Iridescent cream, my loss. Purple mountains, my friends. Buzzards circling overhead, my hopes. Birds singing, jagged singing, my indecision. Wrecked skinny tree, my past. photographs I send home my indiscretion, amber streetlight my reading, my appetite, red striped sky my confusion, bright yellow, gray sky my ardor, car lights my commotion, telephone pole my wishes, stop sign my fear, family dollar, courthouse my opinion, black cloud, white sky hesitation, black cloud, white sky bliss. Blinking signals my intentions, black mountains, too many suggestions, skipping white lines my attention. A young cowboy first saw the lights, a young cowboy first saw the lights, the horns on your van my defensiveness, that old train my dreams, that old train.
Wow. Now, the first of all, when it ends, my heart stops.
Good.
Because I expect there to be, you know, more of it, and suddenly it's like waking up from a dream, you know, but suddenly.
Yeah.
And the poem seems to be made out of definitions.
Right, right. When I was in college, I took a class called Celtic Literature, and we studied, you know, it was all working class Irish kids in a state university in Boston. And so we were learning Irish myths and the stuff that James Joyce used to make Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake and stuff. And so we learned all that, and then we looked at the tree of Indo-European language. And then there was a volume we read called The Penguin Book of Welsh Poetry. And I love Welsh poetry. It was amazing. And there were some poems in there called gnomic stanzas. And they would be like, it would be, oh, blue chill day, the guilty flee, though no man pursueth. And it would be these like lines, these kind of like foreboding lines matched with little bits of nature, you know, and it was just this kind of, there's even a poem in there, I think, called Welsh Poetry, and there's even a poem in there called Harmonica, which is kind of a blues poem, but it's like, it's almost like I was waiting since 1970 to write this poem, because I finally, even a few years ago, because I sold that book a million years ago, and then a girlfriend 20 years ago found a copy of it for me, and I've looked at the poems again and loved them and stuff. And it was just kind of when I lived in Marfa in March, and I loved Marfa, Texas so much. It was a Lennon residency, and bought a house there at the end of the month because I was so crazy about the place. But I was so moved by the landscape, and suddenly it was just like the Welsh poetry came up in me, and I wrote these gnomic stanzas about the West.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Eileen Miles about her book, I Must Be Living Twice, New and Selected Poems from 1975 to 2014, and also a bit about Chelsea Girls. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Eileen Miles about her latest book, I Must Be Living Twice, New and Selected Poems, and about the reprint of her novel, Chelsea Girls. Now, tell me, because, you know, my first ability to read came with fiction. Poetry came a lot later for me.
Mm-hmm.
With you, too, when I started to read your fiction and your essays, they were conduits to your poetry.
Huh.
When people tell you that they don't understand poetry, what do you say to help them, or does it not matter?
I kind of advise them to just keep reading till they find a poem they like. Like when you said, I've got to read 100 poems to get to this poem. I feel the same way. You know, I mean, like growing up, going to school, getting big fat anthologies of poetry, and just finding one poem by Dylan Thomas that like blew the top of my head off. And I was like, oh, I get it. You know, and then you don't find that again for a few years. And I feel that about, you know, teaching writing, you know, which I've done, every poet does, I think, largely. It's just like, I teach the same poems all the time because these are the poems that did that to me, you know. And I know it's maybe not a popular way to feel about poetry, but that's the way I feel. I just have favorites, you know, and they're ingrained in me as patterns.
The Lennons are the principal funder of bookworm of the show.
Uh-huh.
And they've frequently told me that I ought to go to Marfa, and I've never been.
Oh.
You love it.
I love it.
What's it like, Marfa, Texas, where there's a poetry community?
It's an art town. There's a Janaidi, you know, the Donald Judd, the art world is there in a big way. And then it isn't. You know, it's sort of like an Anglo and Mexican-American town. It's a town racially divided, you know, since James Dean's Giant. You go to the cemetery, and there's still a big fence in the cemetery between the white side and the brown side, you know. And it's also a small town. It's just like there's a little grocery store called The Get-Go, and if you walk in there, you probably see somebody. You know, it's sort of like Provincetown in the winter, you know. It's also like East Village in the 70s. It's quiet, you know, in a certain way. There's one event, like when I was there last summer, there was the Desert Surf Film Festival, you know, and it was just like, we're just watching vintage 70s surf movies. Everybody is, because either you go out that night or you stay home. And if you go out, you go to see the movies. You know, so it's very funny. There's so few restaurants. There's really good restaurants, but sometimes on Tuesday, there's no place to eat except for Dairy Queen and Subway. And so you'll go into DQ on the main drag in Marfa, and you'll see, like, fashion models and hipsters sitting there eating at DQ. And you're like, what's going on here? And you're like, oh, it's the only place to eat. So it's a very quirky, I don't know, and it's a walking town.
I feel very thrilled that they gave you a grant, because Lannan is one of the few foundations left that funds literature. There just aren't very many.
And the writing of, that's the tricky part, right? Mm-hmm. It's sort of like to make, I mean, because I think there's something gross about supporting poets and writers, because really what we need is, you know, food and shelter and time. You know, we need, it's just like, we're not asking for a big studio, you know, we're just asking for literal support. And I think that's sort of problematic culturally in America, to just, like, let you be the human that writes the book.
Eileen, you have no idea how much I love these people, because, you know me, what I love to do is read, and no one's going to pay you for that. They made my life possible.
Uh-huh.
They made my life possible. Not only did they make my life possible, everyone thinks that David Foster Wallace, big genius, right? While he was alive, that was one of the only grants that he was ever given. He was in the first group that went to Marfa, Texas, in the Lannan writing community. I feel very proud of their judgment and their taste, even if I'm a part of it.
I know. It's a funny feeling to approve of what helps you.
If not at a school, how do poets live?
Well, they write books, and you get some money from that, you know, and that supports you for a month. And then you go on tour, and sometimes the publisher gives you money to travel. And then sometimes you read at colleges, and you get a check, maybe not today, maybe next month, or, you know, 6 weeks. And sometimes you get grants. I mean, this is sort of the end of the—I mean, I just didn't get a nickel until I was 50. You know what I mean? It's just like it wasn't—or I got, you know, I got a $7,000 grant when I was 30, and I thought, oh, my God, you know. And but you know, my economic ship did not come in. I love doing what I do, which is traveling and giving readings, and I've been doing that for 30 years. You know, I think HarperCollins is like, why are you going on such a big tour? And I was like, this is what I know how to do.
You know? Well, you know, I was speaking to your editor this morning, Daniel Halpern, and he told me that he had heard that they're in New York City at the Poetry Project at St. Mark's Church, that at your reading there were 1,000 people. So, you know, that's been a long time since 1,000 people turned up for one poet. Would you say the last was Allen Ginsberg?
Yeah, I think that might be the case, yeah.
That's so...
And I'm not dead, too.
Yeah.
You know, so Allen had a nice HarperCollins reading at St. Mark's Church in the 80s, you know? Uh-huh. So I don't know that 1,000 people were there for that one. They were there when he died.
For a long time, it was taken as being necessary that a poet be poor,
mm-hmm.
not only poor, but a poet embrace poverty as a kind of ethical standard.
Right. I never bought that. But
I know you did. In fact, in the poems and in Chelsea Girls, you talk about that. Your surprise coming from a lower, lower middle class family in, where are you?
What? Somerville, Arlington, Massachusetts, near Boston.
That anyone would want to be poor.
Yeah, yeah.
Or that anyone would be proud of it.
Well, it's an affectation, and it's also part of the narrative of how one becomes an artist, you know. But the problem is it's a little tricky. If you come from near poverty or something that is very aware of poverty, then it's a little harder. I mean, in part what the Kennedy poem is a fantasy I constructed so that I wouldn't be afraid of what I was living through.
Well, you have a hilarious joke. You address William Blake, and you tell him that if he keeps on reading you, he'll be a great poet someday. Uh-huh. There really is a fun sense that Eileen is the prototype for what poetry might be in a different vision of poetry.
Yeah? Uh-huh. That's good. I like that. Thank you.
Well, it's interesting because I don't know if all of my listeners know. It's not easy. Most of the poetry being published now that's any good are being published by the exciting new small presses that are cropping up all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't pay poets very much, and they can't. It's not because they're being mean or selfish. It's
all they can do is publish books.
Yes.
That's it.
It's not easy. It's not easy to have the money to publish books. But Eileen is... I've stopped watching TV, except I'm going to have to now because you're going to be on it.
Watch season two. Hear my poems.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think it's very, like, amazing. Do you think that there's a possibility that the culture can open up wide enough that poetry can be on television? Tell me.
I think that's exactly what's happening right now. Because I think the thing is, look at the way we, like, use our phones and the way young people text. There's a I mean, just think of how, you know, movies in the 30s and 40s, there'd be a letter. You know, when you read the letter on the screen, and it was just like, that stopped. You know, or silent movies had those intertitles. And I think there's a way in which text is getting reaffiliated with pictures, and there's just a, and the bites and the smallness of Twitter. I just think the whole, the shape of the culture, because it's not been since the 50s that poetry was, like, I went out on Halloween as a beatnik poet every year when I was 9, 10, 11, 12. That was my future. That was the way to be a boy, and that was the way to be something that I wanted to be when I grew up, you know? And it's like, but it was just like poetry was cool cat, man, you know, in the 50s and 60s and stuff. And I think we're there. It's just not, it's not the Gap selling chinos. It's like small words telling us where our freedom is, you know?
Beautiful. I've been talking with Eileen Miles, author of I Must Be Living Twice, New and Selected Poems, 1975 to 2014, published by Echo. They've also brought back into print her fabulous book that was originally from Black Sparrow Press, the beautiful Black Sparrow Press, called Chelsea Girls. I've read it before, but I stayed up all night reading it in its new edition. It's so fresh. It's still alive.
Thank
it's
you.
Beautiful.
That's so great.
I think it's wonderful. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, it's been a ball.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Paul Murray is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.